Welcome back. Please take your seats. Thank you. Now that you're suitably refreshed, the more interactive work is going to begin, and we're going to pick up some of the key themes from the speakers earlier this afternoon in the first of our panel sessions, this one entitled Understanding Behaviour of Firms and Consumers. Now, I'm told that you can ask questions through the IOSCO app, that you can use Twitter, or good old-fashioned microphones will also be available. There might be fun to be had with voting buttons later on as well. And I'm told that you can rate each of these sessions through the app. So absolutely no pressure on our panelists there at all. This panel will be moderated by Linda Yu. Linda is a fellow in economics at St. Edmund Hall in Oxford University. Linda, over to you.
Thank you very much indeed. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming back so promptly. It's my pleasure to chair this session. Now, we heard earlier that everyone seemed to act as if they were the warm-up acts to this as the main event. Well, I'm going to share something with you, is that, in my view, you're actually the main event for this session, because this is intended to be a highly interactive session. There'll be a chance to send in your questions via the app. I'll say about a bit about that in a moment, as well as to have a Q&A at the end. So I really hope that in this session, we can try to bring out some of the issues around the behavior of consumers and firms that would make sense and be helpful to your jobs as regulators. And in fact, that is the theme of this panel, which is how it is that behavioral economics, behavioral finance, which is applying psychology, social psychology to actors, whether it's consumers or firms, how that has changed the way that we ought to view the way that markets operate. Before I became an economist, I used to be a corporate lawyer. And you can start thinking about lawyer jokes at this point is completely fine, because many of you are also lawyers, so I'm going to give you the the leeway to do so. And I remember going into economics thinking, what kind of profession thinks that everybody acts and behaves completely rationally and processes all information instantaneously? I mean, surely this is not how real life is. And then I spent years doing my DPhil where that was purged from my mind, but I have now reemerged. And I think this is one of the most exciting areas to think about, and I hope to bring out some of the key issues for you as regulators throughout the session. I'm going to first introduce the terrific panel that I have with me and then go through the structure of the session with you in a bit more detail. So this is a fantastic panel. I'm going to, you have their full bios in the program, but let me just quickly introduce each of the speakers. We have on this panel David Tuckett. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Decision Making and Uncertainty at UCL. Theodore Kolkokorin, he is on the executive board of the Netherlands financial regulator, and he's the chair of the OECD Task Force for Financial Consumer Protection. Greg Davies, head of behavioral finance at Barclays. Howard Whetston, the chair of the Ontario Securities Commission. And Christopher Wooler, director of strategy and competition at the FSA. So the way this panel is going to run is I'm going to...
That's a pound in the box.
Yeah, this is going to happen a lot.
It's going to happen a lot. I might as well just start collecting.
So how the session is going to work, as I say, is that it's very interactive. So we are very hopeful that you will submit questions via the IOSCO app. And to do that, you need to have your confirmation number from when you registered as a delegate. That should be in your confirmation email, or you can tweet your questions and I will pick them up on this iPad and pose them to the panel as the session goes on. And you should please use the hashtag IOSCO2015. So I'm going to first start off with a few questions that I'm going to ask of you to kick off discussion, and then there'll be a discussion with the panel, including the questions that you'll pose, and then a chance to ask questions using microphones at the end of this session. So let me start off by asking just a few participation questions from you to get a sense of behavioral economics. So first, I want to ask all of you to imagine the UK is preparing for the outbreak of an unusual disease. It's expected to kill 600 people. Scientists have proposed the following programs to combat the disease. So now, can I ask everyone on this side of the room, so this side of the, this half of the room, going all the way back, could I ask you to now look at the choices which are going to come up on the screen in a moment? Technology is like magic. If you could take a look at these two alternatives, which program would you choose, would you prefer to address this outbreak? A is, if program A is adopted, 200 people will be saved. B is, if program B is adopted, there's a one-third probability that 600 people will be saved and two-thirds probability that no one will be saved. So just on this side of the room, can you pick up your voting mechanisms and hit either A or B, please? Not on this side of the room. You have to hold on for just a sec. So just this side. Okay, great. Thank you very much indeed. We'll do your results in a moment. I kind of feel like I'm the host of X Factor or something. I mean, this is... we'll have to create some dramatic tension later on to get this analogy work. Okay, so now for this side of the room, can you now please look at the choices which are coming up on the screen now? So again, the UK is preparing for an outbreak of an unusual disease expected to kill 600 people. Would you prefer program C, if it's adopted, then 400 people will die? If program D is adopted, there's a one-third probability that no one will die and two-thirds probability that 600 people will die. So this half of the room, including the back, please make your choices for C or D using your voting machine. Great, thank you very much indeed. Could we please have the results of the votes? Okay. So, looking at choices, programs A and B, more people have preferred A to B. And then on this side, more of you chose D to C. Now, normally people pick on this side, more people pick A, which is exactly what we have here, and more people pick D. Now, this is inconsistent because if you look at the choices, A and C are actually the same as are B and D. The only difference is that they're framed differently in terms of gain and loss. So this is an example of framing. So if you frame the question, more people are likely to want to save people. So gain is valued differently than loss. So how you frame a question could end up with very different choices in terms of decision making. And you can see this as an example. When travel insurance is being sold, if you're sold on the basis that you might, what you could lose versus what you could gain from buying that insurance. Okay, second question. Can I have the second question up, please? Great. So, everyone, get your voting machines ready. If the population of Venezuela, is it more or less than 65 million people? So how many people do you think live in Venezuela? And those are your four choices. More than 60 million, 45 to 60 million, 30 to 45 million, and less than 30 million. So please, can you vote? For those four choices now. And those are the answers. So almost 30% of you think there's more than 60 million people in Venezuela, and followed by 45 to 60 million. So more of you thought that than having fewer than 45 million. We asked a sample of regulators a very similar question. We asked them, is the population of Venezuela more or less than 10 million people? And then we asked them to guess how many people do they think live in Venezuela. Their average answer was 16.4 million. The real answer is 28 million people live in Venezuela. So this is an example of anchoring. So people are affected by the information, the first price, for instance, that they might see. So a consumer would be anchored by the first price they see of a particular product, and that would shape their beliefs about the rest of about their choices thereafter. So this is an example of anchoring. Okay, let's do the third and final question at this point. A bat and a ball together cost £1.10. I'm pretty sure a bat costs more than a pound, but this is economics, so you always have to suspend some of your disbelief. The bat costs £1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? Voting buttons up, please. Could you please choose one, two, or three? Okay, the first thing it shows is that maths is hard to do in 10 seconds. the right answer is B, which to your credit, just marginally fewer of you missed that, actually, than got it. But the reason why more people choose 10p is that there's two parts of your brain that can make decisions. There's more instinctive part that looks at something and thinks, okay, actually, fast decision, that looks about right, you go for it. And then there's a part which it takes longer to think through problems like math, which, of course, you didn't have because you were given 10 seconds to solve this problem. So the brain has two systems, and so consumers face a similar dilemma when they're trying to work out what's better for them, because they may rely on the more instinctual, faster part of their brains as opposed to taking time and the more reasoned and logical parts. So, and of course, I would guess that lots of consumers probably end up in the kind of none of the above, you know. And that's also one of the challenges, I think, is numeracy, obviously. So I hope this has given you a brief taste of the ways in which we all use shortcuts to make systemic decisions. And this forms the backdrop of our discussion today. So I'm actually going to start off by asking the panel. We've just gone through a number of very simple examples of behavioral economics, behavioral finance. What are the main behavioral problems that you found that affect the way that consumers take financial decisions? Chris, we'll start with you because you're sitting right next to me. So.
Okay. So, I mean, I think there's a range of factors here, but firstly, that sense of anchoring, putting someone in a position where you anchor the price of an add-on item next to something that looks very expensive and suddenly it appears very cheap, even though it's very poor value. We've certainly seen consumers also often resorting to rules of thumb heuristics simply because the problem that's in front of them is just too difficult to solve. And that's a perfectly logical thing for a human being to do, to try and cut through that sort of complexity, but it can lead you to very, very odd answers.
Let me actually bring in Howard at this point.
From the other... I fixed my mic here.
Maybe not Howard.
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
Okay, so Howard, what as a regulator have you seen that you think is important? What kind of behavioral issues have you come across?
Well, look, I think that as a regulator, we see the whole host of behavioral issues in the sense of conduct-related issues between broker advisors and as intermediaries and investors. That whole range of issues is complex. It's difficult to appreciate in the sense of a regulatory response to these issues that are very well known to regulators. I would describe this issue as the classic regulatory problem, if I might put it that way. And the question is what tools do we have to address the classic regulatory problem. And that problem is this relationship between advisors and investors. We want to get that relationship right. We want to get it on the right footing. And the question is, what tools do we have to do that? You know very well we've relied on disclosure and in many forms to be able to address that issue. Yeah. So from my perspective, when we look at these kinds of issues, obviously behavioral science can help us understand and address what those problems are. And the question then is, what remedies do we have to address those particular issues? So the answer to that question is not straightforward from my perspective. And obviously, all regulators are very focused on trying to address that particular issue.
Great. Theodore, let me bring you in as the other regulator on the panel.
I think it's critical that we invest quite a lot in understanding both consumers, but indeed also firms, as the title of this panel implicates. And we're just, I think, beginning to scratch the surface. At the same time, we also need to act. I think in addition to behavior, we should have a focus on the outcomes as well. Because in the end, it's about the outcomes that where the public interest also is. And one of the things that we have taken action on in the Netherlands is going beyond actually behavior and taking away incentives that are actually behaving the way that advisors, such as Howard just said, are how they are giving the advice to consumers. And that actually was a double-edged sword, because it influenced the behavior of firms and it influenced the behavior of consumers. Because all of a sudden, the advisors within a firm, they had the freedom to really go for the interest of the consumer. Before, they were being really steered on performance, commission income. And now all of a sudden they were being evaluated on what's the quality of the advice. Consumers, there were also some interesting changes in behavior. We did some field analysis up front, and we asked consumers, would you rather pay yourself for the advice, mm-hmm. or would you have preferred that it's done via the back door? And at that time, most consumers said, I don't want to pay for advice. And then we asked, well, let's assume that you would have to pay for advice. How much would you actually value this mortgage advice? Mm. And they would say, oh, well, 50 euro at most. And then after this ban on inducements was introduced, and we did the research 1.5 years later, which is 4 years after the first research, the behavior of consumers shifted completely. Now all of a sudden, the majority of consumers were saying, we prefer to pay ourselves directly. And when we were asking how much are you willing to pay for mortgage advice, now consumers were saying 600 to 700 euros. Mm. So it had also a shift in the mind of the consumers as well.
Interesting. David, I want to bring you in because we've chatted before about how you think that this is not the complete set of behavioral issues that regulators need to think about.
Well, thank you. So. In the little test you were given a moment ago, there were correct answers. That's the key point I want you to notice. There were right answers. On the whole, you didn't get them. That's normal. But there were right answers. In the world you work in...
I like to think I was a little bit more empathetic.
In the world that you're working in, and in the world that both the firms and the consumers are working in, the problem is there is fundamental uncertainty. And this fundamental uncertainty means that ex ante, that is at the time you're making the decision, you actually cannot know what is a good decision. It may be possible to know some bad decisions before anyone says it, but what is the best decision is in fact not possible to know. Think of what's happening today in Brussels and the many complications that could arise from it, not just because of what happens in Brussels, but because all the different ways people react to it. So the fundamental point for me is uncertainty. And the second fundamental point is how human beings have evolved very successfully, in fact, to manage uncertainty. And it isn't the case that they've learned to do it by making lots of mistakes. Well, it is in a way, because in a good market system, lots of mistakes are made, but the good products, the new ideas, the things that consumers want eventually come to the top. Now, the problem is in finance, that isn't the way it works. And that's because in order to persuade yourself to take risk in finance, that is to act at all, you have to persuade yourself that what you're doing is going to benefit you. And the problem there, which I could speak at great length about, is that it's then highly open to what I call the problem of fantastic objects, which you see all over the financial market. That is the claim that there are very clever people out there who are making fantastic financial products which successfully persuade professionals as well as consumers that this is the way to go. So, for example, it could be dot-coms, it could be CDOs or CDS or all that. The underlying problem in the financial market is far too much excitement, insufficient anxiety, and therefore a system which actually doesn't deliver the underlying objectives.
Greg, let me bring you in on this point as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, David and I come at this from very different directions, but in the end up at a very similar place. There's an unfortunate tendency, I think of behavioral finance as a long list of biases. You know, I actually saw a website a while back that listed 169 different biases of financial decision-making, which is cute, but completely useless. What on earth do you do with a list of 169 biases? If I was to put my finger on what I think the biggest behavioral problem is in making good decisions, it's the sheer complexity of the problem. You can imagine a situation that pretty much anyone in this country could be in. Imagine that tomorrow morning you wake up and you have £1,000 that you didn't have yesterday because some distant relative has died and left you this money. And what do you do with that? Well, you could put it in your savings account, you could invest it, you could pay down your mortgage, you could take out some insurance, or you could just live a good life for a little while. Even working out the financially right thing to do for those five simple choices that everyone has is fiendishly difficult. And the problem that arises from this is when, as humans, we are faced with daunting choices that are complex, abstract, and difficult, they make us feel uncomfortable, and as a result, we postpone them or we stick our heads in the sand and we don't make them. So the sheer complexity of financial services is, I think, the biggest behavioral problem here. And the fact that in many cases our industries are organized in a siloed way, insurance over here, banking over here, planning over here, investment over here, does very little to help consumers address this fundamental complexity. So rather than think about lots of biases, it's about trying to facilitate greater emotional comfort with the right decisions.
So I like that thought, if you don't mind, but I want to go back to this example here. And so speaking as a regulator again, not a behavioral scientist, and not somebody that has spent a great deal of my life thinking about behavioral science, although I have fortunately been able to engage in a lot of economic work. And believe me, in that model, perfect competition, we know how well that works. The rational actor, we understand that very well. So getting back to this discussion, and Theodore raised this, when you look at these questions that everyone here responded to, the question that I ask in my work is, we think a lot about risk appetite. You've just described that to some extent, and the complexity. We all understand this complexity issue, trying to address that issue. We know how we sort of try and address that issue, simplification of disclosure, clarity of disclosure, issues of that sort, standardized documents, forms, etc., for investors. But the point that I want to make here is, what's the question that you're asking? I go back to the advisor and the client here. Somebody has £50,000 to invest. They want to invest that money. The question for them is, what is their risk appetite? What I see in the industry is the following. Here's my model portfolio. I've got three of them here. And here's what I present to you as low, medium, and high risk. Which category do you fit? You might have an answer to that. I think that that is a completely impossible way to identify what investors need to make choices that benefit them and also benefit the advisor who may be working in the interest of that client and trying to do so. So I'll give you my medium, low, and high and say, you pick.
Yeah.
Complexity, lack of education, lack of understanding the financial product. Help me with this, Greg.
And what consumers will ultimately do in that choice is, as much as we like to think that we are making optimal choices of risk-return trade-offs, essentially what people in the end up doing in a situation of complexity is they pick the one that makes them feel most emotionally comfortable. They pick the one with the best story. So investors don't end up with diversified portfolios of good risk return, you know, risk return investments. They end up with generally pretty concentrated portfolios of good stories.
Yeah. It might not match their appetite for risk.
What we end up with is that, for example, in Germany and the Netherlands, there's huge amounts of money on savings accounts.
Yeah.
So 300 billion in the Netherlands, 800 billion in Germany on savings accounts. And if you would really be sitting together with these people, what do you think you need the money for? Well, it's probably somewhere far in the future. So why is not part of that invested? And that's also because, well, the firms, in this case the banks, if they are really pressured also by regulation, in this example prudential regulation, for them it may be really interesting to have that money in a savings account because it serves their balance sheet. Rather than advising customers, perhaps you should indeed invest part of this.
I want to come to that point because that's an audience question. But first, I actually want to ask the regulators in the audience. You've heard now what the panel say about the ways in which behavioral finance and economics should be thought about. Do you think, because Howard mentioned this to me before, it's actually still fairly new for regulators. How many of you now in your daily work think about behavioral economics or finance? A show of hands. Okay. How many of you did 5 years ago or 10 years ago? Okay. Okay. So I think that is exactly what you and I were talking about earlier, Howard, which is this is still fairly new ground in terms of how it is thinking about behavioral economics should influence regulation. So I want to come to some concrete examples in a moment. But, Greg, I'm going to put a question to you that's come from the audience. What does the panel know about how firms are using behavioral biases to profit maximize and or to help the consumer?
And or. Well, just to address that from a personal perspective first, I mean, my team very explicitly has the mandate it's written down, this is what we pursue. Our job is to bring together the best of classical finance techniques with behavioral finance to help people make better financial decisions. Now, that is not to say that these techniques cannot be used for other purposes. Indeed, arguably, that's what the entire field of marketing is all about. But, like any technique or idea or toolkit, it can be used to influence behavior one way or the other. I don't think that there are, well, for a start, there aren't that many firms out there with explicit teams of behavioral scientists working there. I don't think we've got to the level of sophistication and complexity yet where, you know, there are armies of behavioral scientists beavering away behind the scenes trying to do either or one of those two. Mm. But I definitely think that as long as in the industry we take a long-term perspective, there is absolutely no benefit to us using these techniques not to create long-term shared value with our clients. But that does bring us to another behavioral issue, is the whole issue of short-termism. Emotionally, we have short emotional time horizons. Organizations have corporate time horizons that are often shorter than we'd like. And policymakers have time horizons that are shorter than we'd like. And all of these things do lead over time to a sort of a behavioral pressure to solve today's problem, often whilst setting up tomorrow's problem.
Okay. So, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, come on to that question. I mean, in terms of how firms use this, in terms of the experience we've had at least, I'd agree with Greg. I mean, it's a tool, so it's a neutral tool. You can do this to achieve good things. Mm-hmm. So, for example, there are some firms with investment clients who use it as a way of trying to prompt their client not to sell at the bottom of the market and questions like that. Often, the issues we're encountering are obviously where behavioural biases are being traded on. So, to give one small example for a second, we looked at the car market where you're buying a new car. There's a product called gap insurance, which says if you go out and crash your car tomorrow, we'll cover the difference between what the insurer pays you and the on-the-road price. And it was sold in a way where you would have the salesman standing next to this very expensive object you've just bought. It says, here's this really tiny price you can pay for the insurance to cover the loss. And yet, if you went home and you looked online, you would probably get it for a quarter of the price by shopping around rather than buying it there and now. And so we put some real restrictions around how that product can be sold in the future. And those are the kinds of issues that I think we encounter in that sort of micro level pretty much everywhere we try and apply this.
Chris, another question has come from the audience. And a reminder to please do send in your questions. You can do it via the app. There's a little tab you can click, or you can do it on Twitter using the hashtag IELTSCO2015. Another question following from that, Chris, is that are firms expected to know when customers might be making a mistake, such as the car example that you gave? Is it really neutral?
I think so firstly, I think this has been called different things. It's been used by the marketing department for 20, 30 years. The idea that this is new is, it might be new to regulators, but I don't think it's particularly new to the marketing department. So the question then becomes, I think, is where are you trying to genuinely exploit that bias? And so where do we need to intervene as regulators? Where do we need to say that that practice doesn't work or isn't acceptable? But I think in many cases it's very difficult for people to tell this themselves when they're approaching the questions. And I think where a lot of our work is focused on is in saying where there's an intervention or where people are trying to give information in the right way, can we use these kinds of techniques, can we use this kind of research to make that intervention more effective? So when we look at, say, something like cash savings and you've got an introductory rate, a special offer, depending on how you're told that offer is coming to an end, can radically change how willing you are to go and switch and look around and shop around.
Okay. Go ahead. I was going to bring in David, just in terms of have you come across, in terms of research, anything to add in terms of whether or not this is being exploited and regulators should be more aware of certain instances? Of course, not Greg's team. This is present company accepted.
Well, I think it has become more and more popular and more something that people do. I mean, there are airline companies that hide the opt-out of the insurance in the list of countries that your passport comes from, for example, which my children were telling me about last night. But I think the one of the big issues about all this is which kinds of things really are properly individual decisions and then how to protect them. And which kinds of things are properly should be decided at a different level. And so, to me, I think one of the biggest problems is that the trend over the last 20, 30 years, for example, of pensions being something that individuals are expected to do for themselves has created major difficulties for individuals and has made our financial markets much more unstable, potentially. Because I think it's difficult not to argue that what has happened, you know, asset managers are now the most well-paid people in society. There is academic evidence, endless academic evidence, that very little active asset management is worth anything. Now, that is a big regulatory problem for me. Now, for me, that is a political problem, partly, because, of course, if you generate very high profits, you have a very big influence in decision-making in government through lobbying and so on. And that, I think, is a major, major problem, because I don't think the current finance system does generate what Greg talked about at the beginning. I don't think this is how most businesses are funded. Most businesses are not funded through the finance system, and it isn't really working for that. My explanation for that has to do with this thing called the fantastic objects, that people's belief that you really can, you know, get this hugely wonderful thing is enormously powerful, so that this is what fund managers, for example, themselves believe. Now, I interviewed a whole lot of fund managers, and interestingly, some of the most successful, they did invest somewhat in their own funds, but mostly they invested in Vanguard, i.e. in passive investing, because that is, on the whole, the cheapest, most sensible thing to do. Sure. Well, there's a bit of a problem if everyone did it.
Well, you know, it is happening, though. Recent stats that we've looked at in Canada demonstrate, for example, that institutional investing is the major form of investing that occurs in our society. I think we're at about 55% of all retail investors are institutionally invested. What do I mean by that? Mutual funds, ETFs, and that. Well, that's an interesting situation, because basically you have somebody selling those products to investors. And so before coming, I asked a firm in Toronto, just by way of interest, because my hope and expectation, given your question earlier on, was that regulators do seize the opportunity to develop a greater understanding of behavioral science, but also do the research, gather the data that's necessary. Mm. For many of us, I think we're still at the impressionistic stage. We have not arrived at the point yet where we've been able to invest the resources in gathering the data and working with behavioral sciences to be able to improve that relationship. We all understand, I think you were getting at this, David, the conflicts of interest, compensation arrangements. These all affect very seriously this relationship. And what we're wanting here is we don't want just investors to benefit. We want industry to benefit, but we want it to be balanced in a way such that investors are not losing out. So here I asked this question. Yeah. I said, tell me a little bit about how you're using behavioral science. Mm. Very innocent question. I wrote it down. So he said to me, yes, we're using it now. Very an asset management firm. Specific applications of behavioral science they're using relate to mental accounting, framing, anchoring, and then they're using loss aversion, and parabolic discounting principles to inform the construction of model portfolios. And then I said to myself, great, I'm on top of that. That's going to really help me when that investor comes to us and complains about the fact that they have now lost a lot of money and they feel, to put it bluntly, that they were misinformed by their advisor. And I thought this was very interesting. I want to know more about this. Help me with this. Can we use these tools to improve that relationship? Investor protection is a very important aspect of our work. So how do we get there? So I like it. I want to use it, but we need to know more about it.
That's a great segue to the next question I wanted to ask, which is, can we talk about examples of where behavioral economics has affected policy, changed the way that policy is done? So, for instance, auto-enrollment in pensions. So nudge, I guess, is the term du jour, the work by Cass Sunstein, around this idea that if you have default, Richard Thayer, if you have the default position, most people would end up taking the default position. Any other examples that we'd like to could we raise? Theodore, can I come to you? Putting you on the spot, I'm afraid.
Well, defaulting is indeed something that can be used. Talking about pensions, the whole second pillar of the three pillars of the Dutch pension system is actually a mandatory default. So people have to save in the second pillar, which means also you have to be, to some extent, less concerned on what happens in the third pillar, where there is much more and more freedom. But I also think when it comes to examples, of course we have to understand this really complicated field, but we should also not be afraid of putting the responsibility squarely, first of all, squarely at the doorstep of the firms themselves. And if we see adverse outcomes, not shy away from intervening ourselves. I mean, the example that we just spoke briefly about, a simple example, savings products. A lot of these products are introduced newly in the market with high rates, and then the rates coming down slowly. So all the alert customers, which is a small segment of all customers, they will switch and they will continuously follow the highest paying rates. All the others, let's say, including the mother of a commissioner or a regulator, is not moving at all and will end up with extremely low rates.
Well, so, that's why Martin
and the,
said.
And the funny thing is,
that's what Martin said earlier. You're more likely to switch your partner than your bank.
Yes, but the funny thing, this is already in the marketing toolkit for ages, and there are many other things as well. And in many industries, this is accepted, but in the financial industry, all of a sudden, people are starting to get increasingly critical, and that's the point where the firms should really start reflecting on their own behavior and change. And if they don't, the regulator should step in. So what we have done in the Netherlands is, although by law this is not outlawed, provided that you put the advertisement in the newspaper, which nobody really sees and does not act upon. So what we did is we said, well, you're actually eating away the trust in your industry as a result of this marketing technique. So actually we want you to stop with this. And actually, and after having a discussion, they agreed because they were able to take the longer-term perspective.
Mm, that's interesting. Chris, can I bring you in here?
Thanks. So, I mean, I won't repeat all of Amelia's examples from earlier on of where we've tried to use this technique. But I think the latest one that we're thinking about is how do you try and frame retirement choices for people? So how do you get individuals who are approaching retirement to begin to really actively engage with what the options are that they've got to decide upon? We're out there at the moment trialling this with four major firms, but we've already seen that, you know, just simply tweaking language in certain ways begins to engage people much, much more than certain other kinds of language. So talking about the money you have, talking about the income that you can spend in retirement is a very positive thing. Everybody wants money. That's good. If you talk to people about their investments in retirement, suddenly no one wants to engage with those questions, and that's a very negative thing. So how do we mandate those kinds of sort of language? I think we also have got a lot to learn from other places where this is done. So, I mean, in a wider government sense, you look at, for example, reciprocity. I think that's a really interesting and powerful question that's being used in places like organ donation at the moment to get people to sign up to organ registers. You know, how do you begin to use techniques like that where you appeal to someone's sense of self in order to do something that's actually in a wider interest?
But here's my 2 cents worth on pensions. Everyone has to start saving in their 20s. I think all of you need to push that message. I tell all my students, you need to start saving for your pensions, to which they say, we all have student loans. How are we going to save? But anyways, that is, I think, one of the challenges.
That's too rational. That's too rational.
I know. several of you have already mentioned disclosure, Howard in particular. So I want to move on to the benefits and limitations of disclosure. But before I do that, I'm going to ask the audience again to pick up your voting machines and help me with this question. So if I could have the question up on the screen. The last time you checked into a hotel, for instance, here in London for this conference, did you read the hotel's terms and conditions before signing for your key? Please vote. No. I skimmed through them. I read some of them in detail. I read all of them in detail. Please vote.
I didn't.
Didn't work out the proportion of noise in the room.
No.
Well, you are an incredibly honest bunch. because certainly, and 2.3% of you are definitely lawyers, as Chris just said to me. on this issue, these are the professionals in this area. And yet, of course, most of us don't read terms and conditions very carefully. And Howard, let me come to you. Does this mean that there are limitations in terms of what regulators can depend on if you depend on disclosures for regulators?
Well, look, we absolutely depend on disclosure. Transparency and disclosure is the bedrock of securities regulation. It has been for many, many years. And I think, frankly, when we try and exert our responsibility with industry and become gatekeepers, they're not too fond of that. And it gets in the way of Martin's desire for innovation and product innovation that we talked about. And so it's a very challenging issue because we realize disclosure is the key, it's the foundation, but it doesn't work very well. It works in some circumstances, but it just does not work very well. Now, that's a subjective comment on my part, but I think we can all agree the limits that we have with disclosure, the limitations we have. But we try and do a better job. We have point-of-sale disclosure. We try and standardize disclosure. We try and simplify disclosure. We test disclosure documents constantly with our market. We make all those efforts. But obviously, we also realize, and you mentioned this before, complex products, well, maybe not so complex, but investors just aren't well-educated enough. Education doesn't work. We spend so much time and effort on investor education and financial literacy. It doesn't seem to work so well. We have C8 in IOSCO, a committee that we chair. That I have some opportunity to chair, and I'm privileged to do that. We're recognizing a lot of issues in this area. It's probably an area in this committee that we should do more work on behavioral science. Maybe there'll be an opportunity to do that. So what's the bottom line here with disclosure? I'm really uncomfortable when I have to go to work every day and rely on disclosures as my major tool, when in my heart of hearts, I know it doesn't work that well. Mm. That's rather uncomfortable. If I was a physician or a surgeon, I'd be really uncomfortable with that situation, knowing that when I go into the operating room, the result's not going to be that positive. Mm. It's a bit dramatic, obviously. You get the point.
Well made. Greg, let me bring you in. How can regulators fashion smarter forms of disclosure or consumer communication to make Howard more comfortable?
Well, look, anything that is going to add to the effort of a decision, anything that's going to add to the complexity of a decision is something that consumers are either going to avoid. They may avoid the decision entirely, or they will avoid that information. So you've mentioned a few of them already. I mean, it's simplified. There is a tendency for those of us who work in financial services of any sort or another to assume that lots of numbers are better, that more information is better than less. And that is just fundamentally not true in improving decision making. We need to minimize the information we give to people and make sure it is the right information. Standardization, because the other thing that makes things very difficult for people is, in general, the inability to make like-for-like comparisons between choices or between products. So anything we can do to standardize, you want to have things that will give people the emotional comfort that they're making the decision in a right way. So, you know, this is something that's being used extensively in the retail, food retail areas. You know, the use of kite marks, the use of standardized ways of showing you what the fat and salt content are, etc. These are things that can be brought into finance, but they need to be done in an extremely thoughtful and extremely standardized way. And then, of course, we can go back to nudges. You know, we can go, well, we will just automatically default you into the thing that we believe is right for you. The problem is that very often has unintended consequences, because the default that has been chosen to be right for everyone is, of course, by definition, approximately wrong for everyone. Sure. It is also an invitation when you think, well, someone has chosen this for me, someone clever behind the scenes has figured out what the right answer is for me. It's an invitation for people to engage less and to educate themselves less. So the problem with the whole nudge area is it tends to lead to greater disengagement rather than engagement, and we need to try and bring in where all this gets to, I think, is small, simple, forced choices where you make people make a choice, but you give them clear points of comparison to do so, and you provide what is termed just-in-time education. So it's small nuggets of relevant information at the point people are making the decision, and that seems to be more effective.
David, let me bring you in here.
Yes, well, I think in part there is also a question about what we want to be transparent about. So, you know, I go along with much of what has been said about this, but the areas we're not transparent about are particularly about performance of asset management and similar things. So that, for example, the typical advertisement, to take a famous one, a pair of shoes, a statement that our asset managers can find profit all over the world, we wear out our shoe leather doing it, etc. Underneath the statement that the regulator makes them make, which says things go up and down and you know, you're not safe. But if you look at every single advertisement for asset management, it has this dual thing. And what is it? Have we ever tested what people actually get from this? So I think field testing would be very important in this area. And secondly, I think the message is, essentially, that it's constantly feeding the idea that, you know, it's about choosing the top of the football league rather than seeing that the underlying problem is that the fact that one or two asset managers win each year it gives completely the wrong impression that most people lose more of the time. The reason I think this is important is really to create the kind of environment for professional investors in which they can actually hold long-term decisions. Because if you look at how professional investors operate, they actually are constantly worried about getting phone calls saying, you know, it went because of transparency, they can see that the fund went down yesterday. And I can tell you some who had institutional investors who were ringing up and saying, you know, have you seen that your fund has been down for the last week? And under that pressure, of course, they constantly engage in following a benchmark, which actually means that all the effort is going for very little. So I think this whole area needs to be very carefully thought about and needs a very careful approach to transparency, with the main thing being trying to help people know what the truth is about investing. It's not nearly as exciting as it would appear to be.
Can I just come in there? Because I think we need to make sure that we are focusing our efforts on the right problems. So it is much more, for most investors, most people who have a pocket of savings, and this has already been referred to, are not investing it. They're not using it in a way that sets that up for the future. It is much better for an investor to be invested with an asset manager who is slightly inefficient and not that good. That's than for true. That investor not to be invested at all. So we have to be clear that certain of these things are first-order decisions. Get your money to work, get the insurance you need. Most people are underinsured and are underinvested at the same time. The second-order condition of have I bought the optimal thing, I think we need to put on the side. There's all too much concern about have we given people the optimal choice rather than worrying about have we got them even up to the starting lines in the right way.
Just a quick comment.
Go ahead. Yeah.
But regulators are not into that kind of thought process. And why would they be? We're not into returns. We're into investor protection. Mm. This has got to fit an investor protection mandate. I don't disagree with what you're saying at all. But basically, how should we think about it? Mm. There are three and probably more participants in this area of thinking, which is why I'm quite supportive of behavioral science as a relatively new way of thinking and addressing these issues. You're kind of cutting edge here in some ways, despite those that have put up their hands and say, I've been doing this for 10 years, which is great. There is industry, there are investors, and I'm really focusing more on retail investors now, not the sophisticated institutional investors. And you know, you can pound that out with industry as much as you want, but that's a different group. And then there are regulators. So why is it that we think regulators have the answer? Mm. I mean, where's the confidence in our own decision-making? I'm sorry, don't throw anything at me, please. But on balance, we're all part of this. We are all needing to understand how we approach these issues, how we think through these issues, how we come to a view of how we can regulate in this very challenging area. So I say to myself, please tell me more about behavioral science because I need to have a better understanding of my own anchoring, parabolic thing, whatever it is that you're going to throw at me, Greg and David.
But it's Howard,
I think that's an important matter.
Yeah. I do think, I do.
You got an applause.
Well, thank you very much. It must be somebody from industry. It has to be.
I do think we also need to be looking for the left side of the tail, because if you're saying we're not in the business of returns, I completely agree. At the same time, when we are seeing products coming onto the market, investment products, that are being marketed as having this great risk-return behavior.
Sure.
But in effect, when you really do the calculations, they are even worse than a regular savings account. Mm-hmm. I think it's the job of regulators to step in.
Oh, I'm not suggesting otherwise. And we don't allow firms to say what return they're going to be able to achieve.
Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's this also comes really back to the point of transparency. Because, you know, when we're talking about investment products, no investor is reading a prospectus. No investor is even reading the simplified prospectus.
Right, that's a good point.
So what is this transparency really about? It's a way of the firm saying that once the thing is going sour, well, I told you so, you should have read the prospectus. Mm-hmm. So I think it really, again, we should put the responsibility also at the doorstep of the firm to think beyond what is now required, because I realize we're all relying on transparency, and I'm not saying that we should not continue to do that, but we should, in addition, we should also take a really critical look at those left-side practices where really bad outcomes are happening and really bad products are entering on the market.
I used to spend a lot of hours drafting those prospectuses, but anyways, on that point, if you know that there are these limitations to disclosure and it isn't really delivering the transparency, which is what I'm hearing, then what else should be in your toolbox? What other kinds of regulatory tools, I guess, to try and improve the outcome that you want, which is obviously to achieve transparency, but not relying on people who are simply too busy, it's too complicated, prospectuses are not something that most people would be comfortable reading. Indeed, boilerplate language and contracts, generally speaking, you would not be held. You would not be held in a court of law in the United States to understand everything in a boilerplate contract, not as an average person. So
we work on other matters. What we do is, in some jurisdictions, for example, in the UK and I think Australia, have adopted best interest standards for advisors. They've said, look, we have to change this a bit. We have to do something about this. So let's just change the legal requirements and make it a requirement that we believe will work in the interest of investors, because we know they're not well-educated or they're not going to take the time. We understand they'll spend more time buying a new vehicle than they will reading some kind of a document which might inform them more with respect to their investments. Reliance is a big issue, and we recognize that it's we invariably say at home in Canada that products are not bought, they're sold. It's kind of an interesting thought to me. And you might have some issue with that, of course. They're bought, they're not sold. So we need to often look at the legal standards that we have in place, because our tools as regulators will allow us to examine that to determine whether that relationship is one that regulators are more comfortable with, mostly because it aligns the interests of the industry with investors in this way. We try and reduce the incentives in compensation to work more favorably. We try and deal with conflicts of interest to try and reduce their existence more favorably. That's not to say that we're saying, industry, you shouldn't be able to develop new products, sell these products, and obviously that's very important for the financial markets.
Yeah.
So we need to examine those kinds of issues, because we also realize disclosure is not a panacea.
Yeah. Sorry, let me just, I want to continue this, but actually it's a good point to bring in a question that I've received from the audience, from Simon Andrews. Why is it wrong for banks to use basic marketing techniques widely accepted in other markets with other products and which aren't illegal? Is there an expectation gap between banks selling a product and consumers expecting a utility service, even utilities markets themselves, to win business from their peers? Even utilities market themselves to win business from their peers. Why is the financial sector so different? We accept there's a difference, but can we articulate it?
So
Chris, and then David.
You go.
Fine.
Yeah.
I think there's a difference between marketing a service and trying to, create a brand or, put yourself in a position where you're presenting your best position you can to a consumer, versus some of the questions we've been talking about around disclosure. So, firstly, just to echo what Amelia said earlier on, I don't think there's a complete council of despair here. I mean, I think we are seeing some firms at the best end of this conversation who are now thinking really smartly about how they do disclosure. So people remember comedy, for example. There's one bank at the moment that's trialling a series of comedy videos to do their disclosures. And in the testing and the trials, it turns out that people can actually remember both the product that they've bought and they can actually remember what the terms and conditions were far, far longer than if you give them a piece of paper. So, there are those things there. On the other end of the scale, we still have people selling basic current accounts where the terms and conditions are longer than Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol. So I think it's where you are on that spectrum that matters.
David.
So I think the banks and is it fair that they have to be different? And I think the underlying point here is that I would argue that financial products are different. That is the problem. Yeah. And what basically financial products are, using the example you've just given, they're essentially narratives about the future that the person buying them believes in. And as I've said, an uncertain future. So it's not a surprise to me, and I entirely agree with the idea that narrative is the key thing about this. And because they're narratives, they're therefore extremely hard to value. Actually, asset managers say banks are very hard to value for much the same reason. And therefore, I think that is why you might say they're different than ordinary products, and that's just the reality. And linked to that, it seems to me, the core interest of the financial community should be in developing longer-term relationships with clients. I think that's something what Greg was saying, where since these products are mostly for to be held for the long term with a narrative out to the future, then the underlying model needs to be one that actually delivers that kind of relationship. And this is where you have all the problems of the behavioural side of things, where people themselves are not so good at evaluating and sort of stay with a bad bank or electricity company forever without looking at it. And that's where we need to do something on the regulatory side.
Great, that's a nice...
Can I add two points?
Yeah, of course.
I think there is two other arguments why there is a difference. And an economist would say, first of all, there is externalities. Because if marketing practices are not to the satisfaction of customers to the extent that they actually are losing confidence, this not only harms the relationship between that individual customer and the bank, but it may have a far wider implication for the whole system, which is so central to our economic outlook towards the future. And secondly, as a result of the crisis, everybody has seen that in the end it's the taxpayer which has to step in when things really go bad. Yeah. And that also has implications for the acceptance of people of certain practices towards them in another relationship. So I think those two things are also quite different from other industries.
Yeah, and I think probably I need to move on, but I think that is the key, isn't it? That like utilities, which is a basic service, you can argue finance is a public good in that sense, because without it, our system doesn't work. So they would be subject to different regulations.
I would enjoy the
like
opportunity
utilities.
To determine the ROE from the banks as a public utility regulator. Mm. So would you grant me the opportunity to do that?
We'll have a chat afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, before I leave disclosure, I just want to, because I want to talk about intermediaries, advisors, again, something that we've already moved on to, but I don't want to overlook this question from Boja Ajomale. How much does disclosure and small print affect investor behavior, Greg?
Almost nothing, I would say. I think it has very little consequence for actual investor behavior. I mean, one of the interesting things about the conduct risk agenda that's happening in the UK right now is it's forcing a lot of firms to, in the build of the products and the design of the products and the sales processes, to deliberately put yourself in the client's shoes and say, what about what we're doing is going to change the end decision? And I don't think that disclosure does a great deal of that at all. There's a sort of continuum. At the one end is disclosure and caveat emptor, and the other end is forget about nudge, it's the shove. Well, we'll just give everyone the one product that we've determined to be right for them. And implicit in a lot of this discussion seems to be that we have to find a single right place on that continuum, which I think isn't true. Different people, different consumers need to find different spaces on that. So when you talk about the institutional clients, right, you can put them much closer to the caveat emptor side of things, and for them the disclosure may well make a difference because they've got armies of people who will sit and read through it. Mm-hmm. If you've got people who are more vulnerable, people who don't have the expertise, the time, the energy, the knowledge to do it, they need to be further at the other side of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to think about all of this as a toolbox that we make fit for purpose, and that purpose will be quite different in different areas and for different end clients.
Okay. I want to move to intermediaries. How far should price comparison intermediaries like websites be responsible for consumer decisions? Are these intermediaries helpful? Do they hinder?
I'll talk about it from a UK perspective. I mean, I wouldn't try and generalise about this in other countries. But I think it really does depend very much on the nature of the website. So I think if you understand roughly as a consumer what the deal is here, so that most websites won't give you the whole of market, they will only compare on certain features, and in many cases there may well be some form of sponsorship deal or something that will affect the rankings of that website in terms of the products you're presented with first. I think if you understand all of that and you use it as a rough tool, of, you know, a rule of thumb, if you like, to try and shop around and compare pricing, then having comparison websites is certainly better than having nothing. But I think there's still probably too many people who have the tendency to think that if they've gone out and looked at one of these sites, they've somehow got the best deal they could possibly get. And in many cases, that won't really be the case.
Mm.
Theodore?
I think they can be really helpful in the market, but I think it's also, it requires a watchful eye from a regulatory point of view.
Yeah.
Because typically the business model of these websites is that they will receive commissions from the product manufacturers whose products they are comparing, which in itself does not immediately need to be a problem. But if that leads to comparisons, either in the way the comparison engine works, that is actually moving away from the interest of the customer, or in the way the results of the comparison are presented towards the customer, is moving the customer away from its own interest. I think then there is a case for a really good discussion with the industry and also putting some boundaries on what acceptable practices actually can be.
Mm. I mean, on that point, in terms of as a regulator, how far should you be regulating these intermediaries, whether it's advisors or price comparison websites? Because there are going to be new markets like this popping up. Increasingly, actually. That's one example, but surely there's many others which will come through. Howard?
Well, it depends on the function, really. We're seeing a lot of it in many jurisdictions. For example, without categorizing, we have robo-advisors now. They're called other things in other jurisdictions, potentially. We think we know what they do. It's an opportunity for investors to invest via a robo-advisor. Fees are low. Models are very clear. I've looked at them myself. They're pretty straightforward. The question for us is, are they registered? Should we register them? And if they are registered, what conditions would we impose on them? And so in my view, in a circumstance like that, they should be registered at a minimum. We need to impose conditions of registration. We have to have some opportunity for compliance. We need to have some supervision of these types of entities. And so we take that approach. Price comparison things, I mean, that's kind of a different consideration. But for me, if you think about robo-advisors, which I'm not certainly against, we do register them, and they may be very positive for investors. The issue for me, once again, is I'm uncomfortable with who's making that decision. Because if we think about this whole process of behavioral science and behavioral economics, and who's looking at these sites, what do they know? What are they trying to achieve? What questions are they asking? What questions do they need to ask? So if you really want to think about a caveat emptor, boy, that's a real caveat emptor from that perspective. They're not going to get the benefit of the advice or the opportunity to structure something for their particular needs. So, I mean, I think all well and good, transparency, probably better, but remember what we've said about information. Too much information can also be not a positive thing for an investor who, by the way, may just invest and look at their website once a year. Mm. So they're not doing this on a regular basis, understanding it. And so I think in this case, just basically, if you think about this context, for me, it's a matter of ensuring that we have some supervision, some oversight of some of this activity from a regulatory perspective.
I mean, I do think on this kind of issue and on quite a lot of what we've been talking about, you really do need good research. So not just behavioral economics in general research, but specific research into just the kind of questions you're doing. And it would seem to me that it would be very good to, because typically research in one country, or at least if it's not in, if it's in English, people tend to share it, but there can be very interesting things done in places which nobody's heard of. So I think that IOSCO could have a major role in, thinking about a research strategy, and also maybe somehow coordinating that people compete for these research ideas, because I think the last thing you want to do is sort of give it, to commission it yourself. You want to commission it yourself in general terms, but then let the academic community come up with good ways of trying to do it, which you evaluate.
Great. I want to open this up to audience questions now. There are microphones going around, but I want to go through a couple of the questions that have been submitted already via the app and social media. And if you feel shy and you don't wish to raise your hand and ask a question, you can still submit your question via the electronic mediums using the hashtag OSCO2015. So let me pose this question, which came through a bit earlier from Richard Street. How can behavioral science be used by regulators and firms to better monitor and supervise traders and traded markets? This is like an oral exam. How can behavioral science be used by regulators and firms to better supervise traders and those kinds of markets? I enjoy this.
Yeah, it's good.
More questions, please.
I mean, it depends on what you're trying to regulate.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are for example, my group has a way of being able to analyze text documents to extract from it emotional shifts within things which turn out to be predictive. So you could, in principle, extract a group which are unusually absent in their anxiety in what they're doing, which would on the whole be an indicator that they're not paying sufficient attention to the things that could go wrong. So, you know, there are lots of things to do, but you have to define the question, I think, better.
Well, I do think it's important indeed also to shift attention of understanding behavior within firms, which is a very good example. And we heard already earlier today on the increased attention on conduct risk in wholesale markets by behavior of these traders. So I think we have to understand why is it that they're behaving as they are behaving, and what is the result of the structure in which they're in, the way not just how they are compensated, but also the way they are managed. The way their units are managed.
Their culture, the incentives around their behavior, expectations around...
Because there's all sets of elements in an organization that are really shaping how any individual, if he's going to be put in that organization, is going to behave. And we're still at the beginning of understanding how that actually works towards behavior. And so we really have to invest in that.
So how does it work, Greg?
Well, I would agree with that. But I think there's a more direct route to it. So if you want to engender good behavior amongst anyone, traders, portfolio managers, what you really want to do is to think very carefully about the processes and the systems that they use so that the doing the things the easiest way is doing things the right way. Because we could define, you know, culture as culture is what people do when they don't think anyone's looking. Particularly when they're under stress and they need to do things fast. So now, of course, we can change the cultures of firms. We can you know, instill values, and that's a very important thing to do. But we can also directly pick apart the processes that we put in place in firms and run a behavioral audit on those and say, actually, are the decision points that people are going through correct? Is the information they have on the screen in front of them aligned to the purpose of what they're trying to achieve? And I think there are ways of re-engineering organizations that can very directly and quickly align default behavior to good behavior.
Well, I mean, that poses an interesting question, which I'm going to pose to Chris, which is, isn't the classic problem of aligning incentives in banks a principal-agent one? Because who are you ultimately responsible to? Is it your shareholders, or is it long-term customer value? So it's always been the case, hasn't it, that because you can't clearly define... who you're supposed to be reporting to as a principal, the agents therefore get a lot of discretion around which to act. So this actually harkens back to the earlier discussion of, are banks more like utilities, in which case there is a different way of aligning as a regulator, perhaps defining those incentives so that it's not just aligned to the quarterly reports and in terms of earnings, Chris.
So firstly, there's something that Greg just said and I want to come back on in a second, but in terms of that principal agent issue, you see it everywhere. I mean, you know, Howard's talked about it as well today. I mean, you know, we clearly have to struggle with that issue from time to time in terms of what it does. But I think on the other hand, we've got a set of principles, certainly in the UK, about how you treat customers fairly, how you put customers essentially at the heart of the business model, that aren't that difficult to understand. They may be very difficult to implement sometimes, but actually in terms of understanding our expectations, I think that's pretty clear. I also think, as Theodore said, you know, on this behavioural question that was asked, you know, we really are at the very early stages of this in terms of understanding it in firms. And I think there's a lot of value about thinking about how do you align with what the easy thing is to do. But just seeing Georgina down there in the front row, I mean, I know in the last case that we sort of talked about internally, there was a group of individuals who did have the easy thing available to them and spent an enormous amount of time flipping pay-as-you-go mobile phones to be able to trade illegally with each other, which required a huge amount of effort on their part. So I think, you know, the cultural question goes an awful lot deeper than being able to simply align systems that work.
Good point. There are microphones coming around. If you'd like to pose a question, if you could raise your hand. I see a gentleman in the back row there. When the microphone comes around, there and then here, if you could please introduce yourself and let us know who you would like to answer the question.
Yes, Benoit Goris from ISDA. It's with my end customer hat that I'm asking this question. I absolutely agree that any investor will never read the prospectus, even the shortest version of it. But there is one information on which you always get the immediate attention of the investor. It's taxation. And I do not know one country in the world in which you have exactly the same tax treatment of the whole range of financial products. And I feel that the taxation is one of the most powerful incentives in the decision-making process of end investors. So how can we deal with it as long as you have different tax treatments of financial products?
Mm-hmm. Okay, good, very good question. You want to talk about the bank levy, Chris?
No, not particularly.
Or the trading levy?
Well, actually, I think that this distortion point that was just mentioned is indeed real and can have very adverse consequences. I mean, in a number of countries, when it's about building up pension capital, it's oftentimes insurance products that have a tax advantage compared to, well, economically identical products delivered by a bank. Yeah. Which actually limits competition, and it also, because of the behavior that was described, it tends to limit even further the rationality of consumers. Because once they see a tax incentive, they say, okay, let's get the incentive and let's forget about all the other things I may have to think about. Yeah. So it's something that we have really be careful to be using. And of course, the original proposition of having these tax incentives was to nudge consumers in saving for their old age. So in that sense, it's quite ironical that sometimes quite adverse consequences were at the table then.
You know, from a regulatory perspective, I think it's a really good question. But as we all know, fiscal policy is not the job of securities regulators. It's obviously governments generally, and they think a lot about these things. The end result may not be one that we all enjoy, since we all pay taxes, but we all also realize how tax policy can influence investment decisions. If the investor really understands the implications of the tax policy and is really aware of the benefits or the lack of benefit, bottom line for me is this is an area where regulators are quite engaged in financial planning. And what is the role of financial planners? We all have different categorizations within our countries as to who is doing what. Mm. Financial planners may be doing things like tax policy, financial planning writ large, looking at everything from estate planning to tax planning, as well as investment planning on behalf of investors. And then there are some that are just advising. But by the way, they sneak in some advice when they're not really well-educated enough or have that type of certification or proficiency to do that. So from a regulatory perspective, we face those kinds of challenges. And who is the winner here and who is the loser here? So I think we can understand who the loser might be in that scenario, even if they're paying more taxes than they might for the fact that they've engaged the wrong planner.
Okay. Question here? Yep.
Yes, hello. Hello, my name is Rob Neves. I'm from Lloyds Bank. My question is really a bit of a quandary and also a question, but I'm struck by how little time the industry has spent since 2008, 2009, looking at the role of individual firms within markets, the appropriate social role of individual firms within markets, and making that role, how we make money, where the win-win, if you like, is between the firms and the consumer, more apparent in both the regulatory framework and the design of new regulation, and it also specifically around this discussion of behavioral economics. And I guess if I could open that question by posing it to Howard.
Well, you know, when I talk about social utility in the industry, I fear getting stoned. Because basically, social utility is a very interesting concept. We do realize that financial markets have both an economic and social purpose. And I think the question that you're getting at, and I cannot speak to the following fact. I don't know how much firms are engaged in this area that you're describing. I have a sense that firms clearly are getting more engaged on the behavioral science component and thinking about it more. And after all, they have to think about it more because investors are their clients. And they also understand what we've just been going through, confidence and trust in the markets. We've talked about that a lot today. There's an important obligation to address this issue. How do we think about social utility in the context of securities regulation, just speaking as a regulator? It's a very important question. And I must say, we don't talk about it enough.
Okay. Yeah, question here.
My name is Greg Midcroft. I'm the chairman of the OSCO. Look, you know, I've been talking a lot about culture and conduct recently, and last week in the Australian Senate, I spoke a lot about it, and during this week, there was an article that was published on it that I authored, and what I'm actually saying is, look, it is about human behaviour, because what we regulate is humans, and I think we have a theme in Australia called regulating for real people. And it's a fact, right? Everyone's different. I've actually said that, you know, my view about human behaviour, it comes down to three key traits, what perhaps, drives people in their behaviour. One is that there are some people where credible deterrence is actually what shapes their behaviour, which is they do the calculation of whether they'll get caught breaking the law, and if they break it, you know, what will happen. So that does drive some elements. Unfortunately. The other one is the incentives, positive or negative, right? And then the third one is culture, positive or negative. And I think all three interact in terms of human beings. And I think as regulators, we now realise that it's not just deterrence, it's actually thinking about all three of those. And I think that then feeds into the sort of, if you want, toolkits we have going forward. And what I said is that, we can do this the easy way or the hard way, or I said the big stick or the carrot. And, you know, in the carrot, what we do is when we do surveillance these days in Australia, when we see poor culture, I mean, we do focus on culture and we see it. And when we see rotten culture in large organisations, we generally don't see it in one. We see it across the whole bank, right? It's quite amusing. It's what we do these days is actually we meet the boards of the banks and we go, well, actually you realise you've got a massive cultural problem here and here and here. And I can tell you it's amazing because the boards and the management are shocked because they don't connect the dots in their large organisations. So I think it is changing. And I think I see that as the carrot, which is we can do the easy way or the hard way. But, you know, our frontline people, it's amazing. They see it in the culture. Now, but on the issue of culture, what I said is that, you know, I think we've got it wrong in how we try and deal with culture and conduct these days. It's, you know, as an ex-banker, I think, the way we've responded to it in the past is to, you know, have armies of compliance staff and lots of internal red tape and mountains of paper, and, you know, since the crisis, that's been the solution, right? Well, it's frankly a waste of time. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's sort of getting out of hand. At the end of the day, what we're saying is, you know, it's actually having the right culture is very simple. It's actually about doing the right thing by your customer. Mm. Pretty simple. And I think there's got to be a sea change of thinking, right, which is, you know, you've got to actually identify what, basically, if you do the right thing, you shouldn't need to fill lots of paperwork. It's actually about the right thing. And it is quite interesting. I think the world's changing. I think people are fed up with crap culture inside of financial institutions. They're fed up. And I think it was quite interesting because I was just looking at the latest media, actually. But it's very interesting. There was an article published today on a survey that was done out of the UK, interestingly, but it was actually published in the Australian Financial Review today. And the headline is Culture Matters in Company Valuation, says analysts. And there was a survey done by a London culture consultant, Walking the Talk, that surveyed a global survey of portfolio managers and analysts, which actually found that 94% of them listed culture as an important consideration in their investment decisions. And they basically said that they shun companies that do not have a culture that supports their strategy. So I think that's quite an interesting nudge. And apparently, globally, 60% of survey respondents actually said that their personal experience of a company's culture either enhanced or diluted by their culture or the perception of their culture.
Right. So thank you. Yep.
Culture matters, yep, because human beings actually get it at the end of the day. And
yep,
if they have a poor personal experience or they read about poor culture,
yep,
and I guess what I say to people we regulate, if you don't want to listen to us, think about the front page test, and if you want your reputation smeared off over the front page.
Yeah, that I've
said. And I think that to me is the game changer, and we've had this in Australia, which the big banks, you know, with their bevy of lawyers and that and whatever, have suddenly actually said, my godfather, this ain't working anymore, we've got to change. The change didn't come from us.
Yeah, okay,
the change has actually come from the media, social media, are shaping basically attitudes and saying, well, we're just not going to deal with you anymore. So I think it's a very interesting time, and it is actually human behaviour.
Yeah,
and
you.
Social media. So I just thought I'd comment on it, because it does, in the context of certainly what we're talking about with conduct and culture, I think we've got to think about how perhaps we can nudge better. So.
Great, thank you so much. We are indeed out of time, so can I just ask a quick sum up from the panel? There's one question we didn't get to, which I thought is actually a good segue into a conclusion, which is, why should regulators solve all of the behavioral economic problems? Should investors take responsibility? I can probably broaden that out. Should media take responsibility? Should people take responsibility? Should academics take responsibility? So in that vein, looking ahead, what is the one thing that if we were sitting here a year from now or 2 years from now, sitting in Jamaica, and yes, I would like an invitation to moderate at that conference, please. What would you like to have see moved on, changed, from this conversation that you can say, 2 years ago, we were talking about this, now I now see, I now have, I'm happy to say. Chris.
Okay, so, I mean, to the actual question, I think the reality is we're not going to, you know, regulators are not going to solve the whole thing, but the reality is we are here trying to level the playing field a bit between people who have very little ability to somehow deal with these questions, and quite often firms who have an enormous amount of capacity to deal with some of these questions. If 2 years from now we were saying, you know, something good has happened, I think seeing far more products, far more information when it's actually bought into the market, really properly tested. I think the thing that's really been an absolute eye-opener for us as a regulator is, you know, you can't predict the results that come out of this thing. So, you know, can we see more testing? Can we see a bit more people trying to think about how to do the right thing by their customer when they're putting products into the market?
And that's the great point, well made about culture. And I think hopefully we can see culture change in 2 years. Yep, David.
So I think the starting point is to realise things went really wrong, which I know it's pretty obvious, but it's a bit put under the carpet. The second, I think, is to see the kind of developments discussed by within the panel as a beginning. And the third, I think, is to want to go beyond that to deal exactly with the issue of culture that has been brought up.
Yep.
Thanks.
Thank you. Theodore.
Well, I think, first of all, it's critical that we indeed do invest sufficient time and resources to understand, as we have said a number of times, both firm behavior and consumer behavior. And at the same time, that's the second point, I think it's also critical that we should not only worry about the unintended consequences if we are doing interventions that are not thought through well enough, but we should also worry about the unintended consequences if we are not taking any action at all and sticking to the classical instruments.
Thank you. Greg.
So I'm very encouraged by the degree to which behavioral science is being taken seriously in all manner of areas, but I do think that we need to realise that the body of knowledge that comes from behavioral finance on its own is entirely useless until it is built into product design, process design, culture. It's how it's deployed that matters. And I think it's that transition from here's a body of academic knowledge and a bunch of biases and questions to here's how we actually are starting to think about using them practically. And that will be the coming of age, if you like, of behavioral science.
Thank you, Howard.
So I would like to see, just speaking about behavioral science, how behavioral science, behavioral economics can positively influence business models and allow for a better and more fairer opportunity for both industry and investors to benefit from what financial markets have to offer. I spoke to a very senior prosecutor recently and asked him a question about culture, and he looked me in the eye and said, "We are not the culture police. It's up to the firms to adopt a culture that works for their benefit as well as investors." It was a very interesting thought. So for me, in a nutshell, it would be getting a better alignment of the interests between industry and investors so that there is greater fairness, greater efficiency in the public interest. So that would be my hope or expectation.
Lovely. My final question goes to the audience. I asked earlier how many of you think about behavioral science, behavioral economics in your daily work, and only a smattering of hands went up. After this illuminating panel, how many of you will go away and think about behavioral science more regularly, more frequently in your work as regulators or in your work as in the financial sector? Show of hands, please.
I think they're angry.
I think I completely framed that to create the bias that we wanted to see, but it was my way of showing how much I appreciated the inputs of this panel. So please join me in thanking a terrific panel.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, intra-panel applause while the panel is actually happening is a first. So thank you very much to Linda and our panelists for an interesting, thought-provoking, and also slightly scary session. Some of the key messages are a little comforting. There seems to be a key message coming out that regulators are normal after all, and that it's the belief in fantastic objects which keeps us human. Now, we promised you a bit of history and a bit of culture. Our gala dinner this evening starts at 18:45 and it's at Old Billingsgate. We're sticking with the market's theme by having dinner at Old Billingsgate. In the 19th century, it was the world's largest fish market, so I think it's been disinfected since, so it should be okay. Our guest of honour is going to be Mark Carney, Governor of the Bank of England and Chair of the Financial Stability Board. We're going to get to Old Billingsgate using old Route Master buses. We like our old things here in London. And the buses are going to be outside here, outside the Doubletree Hilton and outside the Park Plaza hotels at 6 o'clock and 6:15. If you have any questions, ask any of our lovely events team who will be at the door. And I'll see you at dinner this evening. Thank you.